this is the first panel I've moderated ever where we came in under the time we were supposed to do that. I only had to flash a card once or twice, so thank you, panel. We can get it in the questions. I think this first panel of the conference gives us an idea of what's happening in the big, wide world. And there's a lot of questions that are happening out there. And we don't have necessarily the same problems in Canada, the United States, that we may have around the world, but we need to think of them because they're going to come back to bite us. We're going to have a conversation among the panel first. And first I want to ask if you have anything you want to say to each other right now before I throw out a question and ask it to you. Adil.
Yeah, I think we've heard quite a lot of doom and gloom stories. It might be useful to talk about a couple of positive things as well. The first one is the financial side of this whole water equation. And I think the good story is that we know now that by investing in water and sanitation issues, we would be able to actually lift a lot of these countries out of poverty as well. So the two are very closely linked, and you heard Maggie talk about, and Liliana as well, in terms of the losses in economy that incur in these countries as a result of not having access to these basic facilities and the health issues that come with it. There is movement now in the international scene to try to address this, and an initiative that started last year, which is called Sanitation and Water for All, a global framework for action. That's bringing together 20 of the leading donor countries with 20 of the least developed countries and where the problems are the worst, and to try to bring together significant resources from one group to the other and try to address those. So I think that's kind of the trend that we will see. We will also see that a lot of those resources actually, instead of going at the national level, start going down to the communities where we know that they can make much better use of it. And also, again, the local economies are buoyed by that type of investment. The second point is, and I go back a bit to the notion of conflicts and water, and I would a little bit differ with what Maggie said. What we've seen in the recent history is that water is actually an integrator, and people can set their political differences aside when they're discussing water, and they can, for a number of reasons, do so quite rationally. And I'll just give you two examples. The Jordan River, there is a very good sharing arrangement between Jordan and Israel. And the second one is the Indus River Treaty, which is between Pakistan and India, which has held in place since 1958 and 59. Even though the countries have gone through three major wars with each other, even during the wars, India continued to make payments to Pakistan, which it is supposed to do under the treaty. So my view would be that while we certainly need to look at the security issues, and as many of you might know, that with our present Secretary General at the UN, he's introduced climate change as a security issue in Security Council. What we're hoping is that the actual security issues that will be considered will deal with the sharing of water between countries. And again, that offers a great opportunity to resolve conflicts before we hit them. And actually, my sense is that water is going to be, again, an integrator that helps us move forward. Thank you.
I wish I could agree with you on both points. First of all, on the second point, that water has until now been an integrator, I think is absolutely true, and you've given the two examples that I often talk about, and I always love the example, usually because the Indians and Pakistanis in the room often don't know about the Indus River Treaty and the fact that that this has gone on despite some really rocky relationships. But the question I was asking is not whether in the past, we haven't found ways to resolve a great number of water-related issues. We have. And the expression, don't poison your neighbor's well, is not a benevolent expression. It has a lot to do with the fact that we don't know the source of your neighbor's well, and it could have a lot to do with the water that you yourself are drinking. So, yes, I think the question is whether, when we look at the new stresses, we're reaching some kind of a tipping point. Aaron Wolf, to whom I referred, says, and he uses the IJC, the Canada-U.S. Shared Water Relationships, the Boundary Treaty, and IJC as really good examples. He says that, you know, basically countries will not have conflict over water if they have a reasonably good relationship among them and if they've got some institutions within the two countries for problem solving. That makes a lot of sense. When you look at where some of those hotspots and those stars and those red marks on the map, whether we're talking about climate change, overuse of aquifers, whatever, you don't see countries that have good relationships between them or countries that have strong institutional relationships for these kinds of issues. So it's a flag of warning about potential tipping points. It's not saying that we haven't found ways of managing water. We have. You know, the last shots that were fired over water are quite a long time ago. So agree with you on there. You know, on whether there'll be new financing for water, stop me if you've heard this song before. You know, we've also got new things coming in for agriculture, new funding promised. You know, development assistance is worth about 6 to 10% of a country's economy. We should be focusing at the national level and at focusing on getting investment patterns nationally changed so that development assistance is the catalyst it needs to be and not the focus where we depend as much as we do on it now to make things happen, because it just isn't there and it's too difficult to be predictable. It'll be pulled to the next Haiti. It'll be pulled to the next problem area. That's the way life is.
I'd like to ask Liliana, because you've been in the field. Why don't you tell us, synthesize those, and what's on the ground? I mean, not to say that Maggie hasn't been either, but she's been all over the world.
A lot.
But
Well, you see underground, for example, One Drop is working in Honduras, and naturally Canadian government is very present there, CETA, because Canada's industry, mining industry, has a lot of interest there. So, of course, when there's international aid, it's always connected to the personal interests of a country. So we always have to look at this with different glasses. I was Monday in Washington listening to a speech from Secretary Hillary Clinton, who was saying that water would become very soon the priority number one of the government when it comes to international aid, knowing that agriculture is also a focus from the States. And they are seeing the very strong links between all of that, and she has defined five streams where diplomacy and security, everything is interlinked with water. And water is at the center, at the core, so many things that you cannot look at it in silos, as you mentioned, and you have to look at it in an integrated way. Unfortunately, I feel that people are looking at water very often in the wash, in the expert wash, with water and hygiene and health. Very often those connections are met. Done very well, but we don't look at the overall picture and other aspects of life.
Nutrition, yeah.
Yeah, nutrition, food security, yeah. And so on. So we have to try to broaden our eyes and try to look at different aspects when it comes to water.
Can I ask Doug a question?
Sure.
Doug, you've been in the business of informing governments for a long time, listening to them, trying to make projections about what they're going to do. How do we, from what you know, and from you've been bringing public attention, which is supposed to be the guiding factor for what most governments decide to do. You've been bringing public opinion for years. What more do we have to do to get water further up the agenda? Whether it's, look at what your results show. You know, first quadrant right up there, Globe Scan and Circle of Blue both done this. Obviously, this isn't enough noise. What do we have to do to move water further up into the area of actually active involvement, expenditure, commitment?
Well, I think the others in the room that probably know have some important experience as well. But I think perhaps a couple of things that there are background concerns and there are top of mind concerns, and water is not a top of mind concern, which we often call, you know, what people are learning about at the particular time, but also what politicians often are in a crisis management mode, and they go after the things that are top of mind. This is a background concern still for people. It's in a way it images the climate debate, which is way off in the future, presumably, and people, you know, had more of a background concern. Once that started to come to the top, and certainly our polling for the BBC World Service showed in advance of Copenhagen, just an absolute moment in time of this being a very salient issue. To the striking thing was how pervasive around the world it was. It wasn't just industrialized countries, but the Chinese were very, very focused on this issue. That happens relatively infrequently, and inevitably a sense of crisis or a sense of opportunity has to galvanize that into a more of a front of mind concern. But actually, people out there actually expect some leadership from people. You know, they don't think they have to figure it all out. That's what leaders are for. And they think their leaders should be doing a far better job than they are, rather than letting all these crises just float up undealt with, so that they're all merging and getting far more intransigent in terms of getting to the solution. So I think that the first thing we tell our clients is don't wait for public opinion. Public opinion tells you point A. You know where point B is. The experts in the room are the ones that should be defining point B. Where do we need to be? Point A, polling is simply giving a deep insight into point A to help you get people to point B. But far too many of our government clients are waiting for average people to figure all these intransigent issues out and come up with solutions. And that's just not what public opinion is there to do. It just people can't put that much time into figuring these things out. Daycare is far more salient to them. Other things that are driving them. So that's where we get into our expert views and our expert panel, which really does, we can really get into pay dirt in terms of what solutions are. And I think that I'm hoping that we get into a conversation about the
crisis,
solution.
Crisis and conflict, and we need leadership. But a lot of these issues, it's not new. I mean, Australia's been dealing with it, and it's a developed country with a lot of money, and they've dealt with some, I mean, I'm not a water expert, but I know they've dealt with some of the problems and have changed the way people live a little bit. And it was a crisis that they got whacked upside the head with, and they're dealing with it. And there are lessons to be learned there, but we haven't had the crisis here to do it to us ourselves. Maybe we can learn from them. I don't know how we do that, either through media or public poll, you know.
These organizations that exist to pull together what other countries have done, put up toolkits. You know, this is how water markets were used. This is how water recycling was done. This is how investment was attracted. So, you know, there's an awful lot of work that is done to make sure that the water wisdom and the water knowledge is available and shared. This is why I keep going back to, but the impetus to move and to make it higher up the agenda. That, you know, it isn't the expertise that is lacking.
It's further down. Someone here mentioned education.
The education's always the answer to everything.
No, but it's leadership and education. And
we
Liliana?
Have in Canada, we're one of the countries that has most water. So one of OneDrop's mission is to educate, but raising awareness is we have to start by that, and we try to do that in different manners, and we have to make people understand that they do have to change their behaviors in order to make sure that we preserve this very important resource. So is it at school, is it playing, it's any kind of way that we have to try to reach out these people, and kids mostly, and youth, so that they have the good habits at the beginning, and that the next generation at least will have them really inside them.
Let me talk about leadership and through a specific example here in Canada. A couple of weeks ago in the throne speech from Ontario, the government did make a commitment to become the water capital of North America in 5 years. And I think this is the kind of leadership that is needed. And just to contextualize that a bit. The discussion that we've been having, we meaning the water community in Ontario, with the government over the last year or so, has been that there is a local demand for addressing water challenges in Ontario, but there is also a global market opportunity. So it's, if you will, enlightened self-interest for Ontario to get into this market, and by serving as a model themselves, they can actually capture the market. And what is the market? At the moment, when we look at the cumulative size of the market globally, it's about $480 billion a year. And the projections are that it will continue to double every 10 years. So we're looking at $500 billion of business in the next 10 years. And again, that's what I meant, that if you start to look at these things a little bit more positively and see the opportunity, you might see that the leadership push that comes from countries or jurisdictions or regions, that will actually drive the sort of the positivity and the investment that is really needed on a global scale. So that's, I think, a good example that we have right in front of us. While the jury is still out, how well this leadership will pan out for Ontario, because they just started this month. But the point is that they have made staked their claim that this is what they're going to do. And that's, I would argue that more of that is needed.
If I can pick up on Zephyr's point and also swing back around and give another aspect of an answer to what it's going to take, I think from other issues, it takes making a business case. And I think what you were just referring to in terms of Ontario is one that I think we as Canadians really have to think about. How in this kind of a world that we've just seen, with the abundance of water that in this country and a public opinion in this country absolutely opposed to any exports of water, how do we square that with our conscience? You know, 50 years from now, how are we going to square that? And so it almost goes beyond a business case. Certainly the business case is there in terms of opportunities. Where do experts think the solutions are? It's not in increasing supply. It's in demand management. It's in the management of demand through efficiencies and through public education and through social marketing that has been successful in Australia, was hugely successful in Brazil when 6 years ago, I remember one of the times I was there, and a lot of hydroelectric power, their dams were dry. They bad rainfall. Everybody just got busy and saved energy, and coming out the other side, their energy profile was significantly down. So these things can be done in an imminent kind of way. But we as Canadians really have to think about how are we going to square this, and the experts say there's a way through this, that the opposition of Canadians to bulk exports of water does jive with true solutions, which are demand management solutions rather than the increasing supply. And so it goes beyond a business case. It goes to a country mission that I would dare say, having lived in the UK for 6 years and just back in Canada, I would dare say we need one. We need a whole slew of them.
Anything else up here?
You might just add that Canadians use twice as much water as the next country on the list. So we've got quite a long way to go.
Americans?
Oh, yes. American water use has gone down, 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 because after the EPA was passed, the Environment Protection Act, they started to clean up the water that went into industry and put it into a closed-loop system. So both aggregate and individual demand use per capita has gone down, whereas Canadian water use continues to go up and up. Bob Sanford will give you an earful on this.
We have infrastructure problems, too, that seems like every other day in Washington there's a water main break because they're all so old and they bust. At least they bust and we know about them, and they're not cracking and leaking underground and letting all that out. Okay, let's go to questions. Where are our two microphone people? here and in the back. Okay. I'd like to take two questions at first. Sure, there's got to be some questions here. Okay, here and Lily.
Yes, hi. My name is Marie-Josée Richard. I'm a freelance journalist. I'd like to know mainly what do you think the medias and new platforms such as Facebook and Twitter can do, you know, to re-enhance all of these questions we need to attire the public opinion? Thank you.
Okay. Question on social media. Lily?
Grand Prix. I was just wondering, and it's for Doug Miller, when you say we're not ready to share, are we not ready to share with the U.S. or are we not ready to share with Africa? Because I would think that public opinion might be different if we ask the question separately.
Okay. Social media and other new ways of getting information out. Maggie?
Let me start while you're thinking. Social media, absolutely, because I describe this as a wicked problem, something that if we don't come at this from 100 different points of intervention, we really won't get where we need to go. And I think social media is enormously important in doing what Doug talked about, in shifting this from being a supply problem to being a demand management problem. Demand management is just the word water people use to say, you know, try and reduce, use more efficiently, more effectively. So I think social media has to be play a real role in building a new water consciousness that extends from personal behavior to questioning behavior about how is my river basin being treated? How is my river? Is it healthy? Why is a new piece of infrastructure necessary? Why aren't old ones being fixed? This kind of thing. So I think it's hugely important. By the way, we export oodles of water. It's called virtual water. It's the water that goes into growing wheat. It's the water that grows into making automobiles. All of this is water exports. In fact, when China decided that they didn't have enough water, they imported wheat from Australia, which was in the middle of a drought. And, of course, that wheat couldn't be made without lots of water. So, in fact, China was importing water from Australia because it takes water, and Australia irrigates their wheat. And so, therefore, it takes irrigated water to grow the wheat that they were importing from Australia. So we export lots and lots and lots of water. Every country on Earth does. It's called virtual water. It's the water that's embedded in manufactured and agricultural goods. Not from me.
Social media, I have a question about media that I wanted to, since we're on the media question, but Doug, did you want to add something to that?
I was just going to answer the question directed to me. Clearly, there's a difference there. The challenge is how to get the water to Africa. It's easier to get. Clearly, the issue is framed as bulk exports of water to the U.S., and Canadians are hugely, massively opposed to that. So, but the empathy for Africa, I think experts could argue that we could do a far better job in Africa helping them husband their resources than trying to figure out how we're going to drag, you know, floating things.
If you did a poll in the United States of how many Americans thought about bulk water imports from Canada, Zippo, nobody. Americans do not think about getting water from Canada, and where it's almost a national emotional, oh my God, here, that it's just not thought about at all. It's conservation, other manners. We wouldn't import water from Canada. And if you look at what's happened in, now it's time I might shameless, we did a program, I think this is what got me here. We have a program, a publication called One Issue, Two Voices, and we did it on water abundance. We had a Canadian author, an American author, and the Canadian author you'll hear from later in the conference. And just one thing that I learned about that, during the incredible population growth in Las Vegas in the mid-2000s, whatever, the water use actually went down.
California as well. Yeah.
So it can be done. And so sit back. We're not going to import your water. You can send it to Africa. But I wanted to circle back on the media question. Does media get it right? Is media portraying the water issues in the right way? Or are they sending us in a direction that's not quite helpful, or should we be going in a different direction?
Well, could I try to answer maybe the question that the lady asked first, and I'll come back to this one. I think you're absolutely correct. Media does have a very significant role to play. However, which media you use, I think, depends on where you are. And the kind of problem that I was presenting in terms of those maps, the vast majority of the problem are in countries where they don't have access to the internet. Well, in many of the countries, they get power maybe 2 hours per day. And so the approach and the tools that we use to get to them might be very different. Fortunately, maybe in some of those countries, the cell phone usage is very high. So maybe Twitter would be a very effective tool to get to them. But again, we have to think a little bit more innovatively and maybe keep in mind where the bulk of the problem sits. It's of course, we need to mobilize resources from the developed world, but that's not where majority of the problems are at this moment. Now, in terms of your question about what kind of job the media are doing, and in fact, just 3 days ago, I was in Nairobi where we had a workshop with 60 journalists from all over the world. And this question came up quite a bit. And if I can generalize, it seems like that the way media interacts with issues related to water is driven by a large part whether they can relate to it in a local sense, meaning that if you talk about the global problems, you will get very poor traction. And actually, we've seen this quite a bit in Canada as well, that unless you can localize the story and put a hook which the journalists from your city can understand, they will most likely not even cover the story. So that's, I think, one common trend. The other one is that I think the journalists, and again, I'm generalizing, my apology to any of the journalist colleagues here in the audience, generally speaking, they don't get the story correct. They don't have the basics correct. And now you can apportion blame in equal parts from on the experts, so to speak, that they don't get the stories right across. And I think there's also equal blame on the media that there isn't enough effort injected into educating the journalists about what the issues are. And that's precisely what we were doing in this workshop in Nairobi, to change the mindset to some extent and to introduce what the issues really are. And hopefully, you know, that perpetuates a cycle in which the right information gets to the public and that changes the public opinion.
Let me just add something to that. Of course, social media is extremely important in developed countries. The reach, the potential, the future is there. As my colleague has just said, in developing countries, there's little access, if no access, to these type of medias. And we believe, and I think that anybody who's worked into developing projects, the importance of community education, popular education by different means. We use at One Drop social art as reaching the people's imagination in order to make them change their behavior. There's many different other ways of reaching the people, you know, in those communities. Might it be local radios, because often that is the type of media that is used. But there is a distinction between those the developed and developing countries.
Okay, Dr. Castillo. Wait for the microphone, please.
Tom McCauley, International Joint Commission. When we're talking about water exports and we're talking about media, I was just thinking of we have a really interesting example here about 2 years ago, and many of you may remember this. There were all kinds of articles that came out about L'or bleu du Québec, and there is a group that call themselves the Montreal Economics Institute. And according to whatever study that they did, the water in Quebec is worth much more for export than even what they make out of hydroelectricity. And I found that really strange and curious, and I started just doing some takeoff calculations, and I found that in the United States, for instance, you pay between 30 and 80 cents on average for a cubic meter of water, which is a ton. And irrigation water is much less. And when you put water onto a ship, you look at those ships going out the St. Lawrence River, and rice is worth $1,000, well, it went up to $1,000 a ton. A lot of products go between a low of, say, $160 a ton, coal or whatever, all the way up to well over $1,000. Water itself, if at the port that you're bringing it to, if it's worth between 30 and 80 cents a ton, you're going to ask this shipping company to bring this water somewhere, and he'll say, do you want me to go as far as Rimouski?
Yeah.
Because then you're going to run out of money, you know? And then I looked into it again, and they were thinking of moving water from Tasmania to Australia during the drought. It's not very far away, but it fell through, and that was about, I forget, 3 or 4 years ago. And Alaska's been apparently trying to sell their water to, I mean, it's a lot shorter from Alaska to California than it is from Quebec to California. So there's a lot of things, but I was so curious that this snowballed in the press, and a lot of people were thinking, wow, you know, we can make a lot of money on water.
Well, if we raise the price of water to, I mean, really differentiated for what uses we have, too. I mean, by and large, watering the garden water, you pay the same as the drinking water, as you pay for the other stuff. And the smart minds can think of ways to figure things out. Any comments to that up here? Doug, then Maggie?
Yeah, I have. We explored water pricing with our expert panel, and found we tested a number of different pricing models. And we don't do this amongst the general public because it's pretty complicated. But with these experts, we did. And what came out was that the preferred model that these experts had was a very, very, very low price for the basic amount that humans need to live with dignity, and then marginal cost pricing from there, so that it would the more you use, the higher the price. So marginal cost pricing is a common element in, or it perhaps should be more common in energy circles. But that was the kind of pricing model that these experts preferred. Just to feed that in, it's a pretty critical question.
Well, just to supplement this, you know, the world is not running out of drinking water. If we use 70 to 80% of all the water that we abstract for agriculture, if you divert a very small amount of that, you get all the drinking water that you're going to need within any kind of country. What we're running out of in places is economic water, and that's the water to grow the food, feed, etc., a lot of which shouldn't be being raised there in the first place. And so we really do need some of the things I was talking about, which is relooking at trade, because your lovely image of the tanker with water, you know, pulling up to fields that need to be irrigated, but until that time have been paying even less than we pay for drinking water. The economics of it just don't work. So, first of all, only 7% globally of all water that we abstract of the 2% of the 2% is drinking water. So we're not running out of drinking water. We're running out of economic water, and we should start looking first at why we're taking on those economic activities, where we are taking them on if there isn't an adequate water supply. So we've got to really start looking differently at it. As Adil says, look at it positively from the opportunity cost. What can we do differently in different locations to take better advantage of the water resources that exist in different places? So I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's part of the prevailing myth. And it's part of the, I think, the media does us a disservice in Canada. They look at water through two blindfolds. One is called bulk water sales, where routinely we get kind of hysteria stirred up. And the second one is called public versus private for delivery of water services, which is back in the 7%. And we hardly ever get anything that talks about rivers, lakes, aquifers, the water resource base that is part of our country. And I think we really need to have a lot more concentration on the water resource base rather than these two issues all the time.
Over here.
I'm Andrew from the University of Guelph. We've addressed kind of the public health and sanitation and drinking water side of things, but I was just wondering how does this affect maybe on an ecological or an environmental standpoint? Because that's a critical part of the picture as well. I feel like that's the one part that's always lacking when we're talking about this discussion. It's one thing that's set aside because, you know, there's some areas that there really population increases, but there will also be more stresses put on the environment. Also in Canada, if you look at it, there'll be more water coming to within our environment, so it'll be interacting quite differently. So how is the tier of in sustainability environment kind of in put in terms of the international context? Sorry.
Let's take this other question back here. We'll do two.
My name is Lorraine Anderson. I work for the Department of Foreign Affairs. I have a question about the rights discourse. It's kind of a two-part question. The first is I'm just wondering if in the sustainable development community, if there's a discourse on a right to water in the, for example, for UN water, does that come up a lot? And if not, are there any steps to be taken to incorporate that approach? I also have a question about countries that, in fact, have recognized a right to water, if you have seen a change in the policy development or legislation or things like that that have positively affected some of the problems that we've discussed here.
Ecology. Sure.
Yeah, I think there are actually two aspects of what we can call ecological uses of water. One is the quantity of water, and the vast majority of the river basins in the world have been modified as a result of construction of dams and other water diversion structures. So the quantity is significantly changed, and it continues to change, although now we see that there is a growing resistance to at least building large dams. But I think that is a significant issue. And I've heard, in fact, a UN colleague one time speak about that the Egyptians should not let a single drop of Nile get to the Mediterranean. And I cannot begin to tell you how skewed that understanding is of the ecological needs for water. The other aspect is the quality of water that is also needed, because it's not just how much water you get, but also it has to be of a certain quality. The one statistic that we heard quite a lot during the World Water Day, which was this Monday, is that there are 2 million tons of untreated wastewater which is discharged into the water bodies every day. That means that the quality of water that's getting into the ecosystems is going to be very significantly impaired. And particularly the coastal ecosystems where everything ends up are seeing severe consequences. We have coral reefs being destroyed, and there's also impacts on fisheries, because a lot of these mangroves and coral reefs also happen to be the nurseries for various commercial fish species. So there are very significant impacts, and the discussion on water quality, which is a big focus this year, I hope that will bring attention to the ecological side of things. And I think in many ways, in terms of even when you draw it back to human well-being, this is a very direct driver, and we have to take that into account. Let me, if you may allow me to touch briefly on the rights to water issue as well. And I think water rights and full cost pricing, what Maggie was talking about a moment ago, are flip sides of the same coin. I think somehow we've gotten into this fallacy that the right of water means that it should be free. And I think somehow we have to get over this this fallacy that processing water, which means treating it, supplying it, pumping it to somebody's house and making it available to the people who need it actually does cost something, and that has to be taken into account. And I think it's been an issue where most politicians will not touch it with a 10-foot pole because they see that this somehow, talking about full cost pricing, will somehow take it away from this notion of right to water. And I think this is an absolute fallacy, and we have to get out of it. Again, if I can give you an example, I visited a small fishing town just a week ago on the shore of Lake Victoria, where we are helping water supply, which is untreated from a spring, to bring into a small town of 40,000 people. And the people in the town and the local government have put their money into this infrastructure. They're still going to have three kiosks in the town where they will buy a jerry can of water for about 50 shillings, which is, if my math is correct, is less than a dollar. I think it's about 70 cents or 60 cents. And they're willing to pay that price because they're getting good quality of water easily. And these are people who are, otherwise you can describe them as dirt poor. So I think this ability to pay is significantly there, and we have to take that into account.
When it comes to the question of right issues, I just wanted to point out that the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations has named special advisor, I don't know what's his...
Albuquerque.
Yeah, but her title, official...
She's the Secretary General's official representative on rights.
And she has just started a consultation about, you know, good practices when it comes to the rights approach to water in projects. So, and she's focusing her work of last year, of this year, on the access to sanitation. So there is a lot of work within the right-based approach that is being developed right now. I would like to agree with Dr. Adil. There's a lot of work to be done in the mind of people. When we talk about the right to food, it doesn't come to our mind that we're not going to pay for that food. So the right to water is the right to having access to water. But it is the responsibility of state that if a person cannot pay for that water, as it is essential for its survival, to provide it for free. So that's why sometimes there's this notion that there's a minimum liters per day that a person needs to survive if that person cannot, you know, pay for it. So there's the discussions right now are very often around these points.
On the cost recovery deal, I don't think really very many people are talking about full cost recovery. I think the hope is that you'd get a good deal of operating cost recovery so that you'd at least be able to keep leaks and employment and things like that. Water has always been in part publicly financed. Now, when you don't have a taxpayer base, there's the public that can finance it is not very big. But, you know, if we could get to operational cost recovery in a lot of places, we would be taking a big step. It's just precision on what you're saying, because I agree with you. On the environmental bit, there's some good news there, too, you know. You weren't around when the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland burst into flames. They made a good folk song about it, about God can't make that river burn. But the river was so polluted that it actually burst into flames. And, of course, what they tried to put it out was with the river, which then... accelerated things quite badly. And there were a number of rivers in the world, certainly the Mersey, certainly a number of rivers that were just about in that point. I think actually the Mersey once caught fire too. And over a 30-year period, things have really improved where the communities have some wealth and where they make this a priority. There's a fishing contest in the Seine every year. And they're now up to something like 42 different kinds of fish back again, and whereas there was at one point almost no fish in the Seine. The IJC, which is Canada and the United States working together, have had some real successes in trying to clean up stressed parts of the Great Lakes. That doesn't mean there's still an awful lot of threats and alien species and real problem areas, but there have also been real successes. The problem is there's not enough of them, and that they tend to be put serially in people's minds as we'll get rich first and then we'll clean up the environment later. That is what our world did. In terms of how people look at this, many countries have a water reserve law so that you can't abstract more than 40% at lowest point of the river so that you're protecting the actual you know, the actual level at which you need for the resources that live in and around the river. There's no international standard because all rivers are different, but there are an awful lot of people who try and work these things out, monitor them, and watch over them. Your question was excellent, and the panel should be greatly demerited for the fact that not one of us mentioned it when we are talking. So,
in the back. This will be the last question.
I'd like to follow up on a number of points that Maggie keeps coming back to, which is that the
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm David Brooks from Friends of the Earth Canada. Maggie kept referring to agricultural water. This is 70, and in many countries, particularly those with low water resources, 90% of the water. It's the big term. We have a pretty good idea of what to do about the drinking water, household water, sanitation nexus. We know we can get it to people. It's mostly a problem of governments that don't respond to poor people. Usually rich people have enough water and poor people don't. It's a relatively minor quantitative term in terms of the quantity of water, although I realize it's significant. We don't have nearly as much even a concept of how we approach agricultural water. It is classic around the world for governments to build very expensive irrigation systems and to charge farmers either nothing for the water or just, it's a struggle to get them to pay the operating costs when the capital costs are 80 to 90% of the value. We don't have a good concept, and this is not just a third world problem. I'll give you one quick example. In Ontario, there was a big push after Walkerton to have a water source protection law. It went through that way until the agricultural lobby got in charge of it. What we end up with was a drinking water source protection law with agricultural water exempted, even though it's the big talk. And the problem originated partly through a bad agricultural practices. So this is what I'd like to ask the panel. How do you approach? This is not what's in people's minds. They don't even think of agricultural water. They think of drinking water quite sensibly. I mean, it is what they ingest. But it's the global problem, and even the Canadian problem is agricultural water.
All vitesse.
I'll start off. There's low awareness amongst the general public that fact exists, that agricultural water is such a large percentage of our water needs. I think I think it was you, Maggie, earlier said that there wasn't a UN agency focused on, and I forget your example, but there isn't a UN agency or anyone focused on people like us having our intake of meat. But I would suggest that there is a social marketing initiative that could the linkages could be made very effectively. And it's not, you don't have to go vegetarian, but just have the intake of meat. Some have argued that would solve a lot of this in and of itself. Where are the bodies to do that kind of social marketing? Social marketing is a science that there are a lot of practitioners of, and it works, and there are people who know how to do it. They're terribly underfunded and never given a chance over the let the engineers get to the problem. So here's a resource of people who know how to do this, a very simple call to action. I would suggest that could be a very successful program. People need simplicity, something to focus on that would actually lever a significant amount of change. The details that we're going into in this conference are not details that people can get into in their average in their daily life.
We are quickly. We're over time.
Okay. Well, I'll skip that.
Okay. I think we've had a good discussion this afternoon on some of the challenges that face water in an international sense. The right to water, are the terms defined correctly? Does the media report it correctly? Is government doing enough? Is the private sector doing enough? Do we understand what we need to do? We will have a 12-minute break, stretch, get some air, and come right back because we've got a fantastic speaker at 6 o'clock.